Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio's continuing efforts, not broadcast live from CFUV Radio in the basement of the Student Union Building at the University of Victoria, but emanating live to tape via Skype from our home-based studios on this date, August 24th, 2020. Well, nearly 9 months into the most disruptive, if not destructive, pandemic known to history, how is it we still do not definitively know where COVID-19 came from? After tens of thousands of television hours and millions of words printed, why must we still ask this most fundamental question? Dr. Jonathan Latham holds a master's degree in crop genetics, a PhD in virology, and is, along with Dr. Allison Wilson, co-author of a trilogy of articles seeking to both discover the origins of COVID-19 and forewarn the public of the dangers posed by the kind of research they posit is at the root of this and other modern pandemics. Latham is too co-founder and executive director of the Bioscience Research Project, editor of Independent Science News, and director of the Poison Papers Project, publicizing documents of the chemical industry and its regulators. He's published peer-reviewed scientific papers in disciplines as diverse as plant ecology, virology, genetics, and RNA biology, and his many science articles appear at Fair, Truthout, Counterpunch, and The Ecologist, among other places. Today, Jonathan Latham and proposing an origin for SARS-CoV-2 and the COVID-19 pandemic. Well, welcome to the program, Jonathan.
Oh, hi there, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Now, three of the articles you and Allison Wilson have published, the case is building that COVID-19 had a lab origin, a proposed origin for SARS-CoV-2, and the COVID-19 pandemic, and engineered COVID-19 infected mice, or mouse rather, bites researcher amid explosion of risky coronavirus research, that triangulate, for me at least, where we've come, where we are, and where we're going should current laboratory practices continue. Now, your and Allison's June article, The Case is Building That COVID-19 Had a Lab Origin, outlined some of the horrifying precedents of lab-linked pandemic outbreaks. Why, Jonathan, is that possibility considered by many authoritative voices within science circles as outlandish or worse, a conspiracy theory now in the case of COVID?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I mean, the simple answer is that a conspiracy is what you call something if you don't like the idea, right? And what they were hoping was that there would be some kind of purely biological origin that emerged, you know, as a simple narrative to explain this illness and a pandemic, rather. And that's not happened. And what we and, you know, other people have proposed slightly different versions, human escape, lab escape type theories with more or less genetic engineering in them, or more or less biowarfare in them. That is not the traditional domain of science. And so scientists are very kind of reluctant to discuss this. And, you know, the issue for them really at the end of the day is they have conflicts of interest, right? There is a kind of an industry, you know, what we would call the pandemic virus industrial complex, you know, these a whole set of people who are making diagnostics, making vaccines, making antiviral treatments, trying to predict future pandemics that rely on the kind of research that was going on at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And that is exactly what we think led to the pandemic. And so, you know, it's hard for them to argue against it without also giving credibility to the kind of thesis that we put forward. And so the simple thing is you call it a conspiracy and say nothing.
Well, the biggest proponents of the zoonotic pathways theory is Anderson et al., and they are published in Nature Magazine, or Nature Medicine, rather, online, and you take them to task. It sounds to me what you're describing is counter science, that they've got a narrative that they're trying to fit the science to. Is that too harsh a critique of what they've done, Anderson et al.?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we don't know how much they know. You know, it could be they know much more than has been publicly revealed about what happened at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Certainly they're in the top ranks of the loop of people who have conversations about this, who are professional virologists and on the inside of the loop of the pandemic virus industrial complex. But maybe they just were, you know, extrapolating from what happened with SARS-1 and MERS, right? So those two pandemic, you know, near pandemic virus outbreaks, SARS in 2002 and MERS in 2012, they basically are really considered to have originated through an intermediary species. So MERS came from bats and infected dromedaries and then infected people, and SARS infected civets, and then it infected people. You know, so there was a civet outbreak. There was a dromedary outbreak at that time, which could be identified. And there's, you know, I don't argue with the evidence that there was an animal zoonotic origin for that. And I think, you know, it's a very comforting theory for them to imagine that a similar story would emerge in the case of SARS-CoV-2. And you know, part of the evidence, one of the stronger pieces of evidence in favor of our thesis is that there is no counter narrative has emerged that has any credibility, right? There's been no outbreak of bat coronaviruses in any other species. We can't work out which species it might have been. The story keeps changing, and so forth. So I think it's difficult to answer that question, but it's easy to see what might be going through their minds. Yeah.
Well, I was amazed in your article, A Proposed Origin, that you said you say in that article that the SARS, as you mentioned, the previous SARS, the 2002-2003 SARS outbreak and the MERS outbreak of 2012, you say that they're probably, but it's still not proven that there was a transition via intermediate animals. How could it be that all these years later we still don't know, we don't have the answers to that? And does that mean that we can expect 10 years or 15 years from now to still not have the answers to COVID-19?
You know, answers can be hard to come by. You know, people have this idea that science produces certainty, and and, you know, for the most part that's not really true. You know, think of Einstein's theory of relativity, right? We still launch satellites and look for gravitational waves to try to prove and disprove it, right? So all theories and all data really in science are provisional. So you have to kind of like, that is a kind of philosophical starting point. And so, you know, what we wanted to draw attention to in by saying that, you know, it's not proven is there are still doubters out there about animal intermediates. But none of them, so far as I know, are proposing that there was a lab escape. I have not heard anybody, because there are people who doubt whether it was really civets or doubt whether it was really dromedaries, that kind of thing, whether it came straight from bats, for example. So there's still questions.
Well, I read recently, and I can't remember the fellow's name, but as a way of disproving the lab escape theory, he simply said, well, these labs, they're very good at protecting viruses, and so that didn't happen, or that probably, or the likelihood is very remote. But you draw that into question too, where in fact these lab escapes aren't so rare as we'd like to think, are they?
No, they're not. You know, they're hundreds and hundreds of examples of mishaps and near escapes and actual escapes that have afflicted these biosecurity/biowarfare labs. You know, somebody estimated at one point there was one accident per day in U.S. biosecurity labs. And unfortunately, I can't remember the reference. But really, these things are very, very common. I mean, we drew attention in the final article that you just raised of a mouse bite in North Carolina. But just a couple of days later, ProPublica brought up a list of six different coronavirus lab escapes that it happened. But you could draw up many more. You know, there are still questions, for example, about the Ebola virus outbreak in 2014. You know, there's a guy who's written a book. He's independent of the virological community. He wrote a book, and he went and interviewed the father of the sort of widely considered to be index case. So there's one scientific paper basically that says Ebola in 2014 arose because a child was playing with bats, caught Ebola, and they were the origin of the outbreak. There's some problems with this theory, though, because first of all, the child was never diagnosed with Ebola. The second problem is that the child was only 18 months old and probably way too young to be playing with bats. And the third problem is that no one ever identified anybody who caught Ebola from the child. The father is still alive and the mother died sometime later from malaria. So the story that this child was the origin of the Ebola virus and that it came from bats is really, really weak. But we do know that there was biosecurity research going on in that part of Africa in a hospital, and people were basically bringing in cases, individuals who had Ebola virus to this hospital, and that appears quite likely to be the potential source of that outbreak. So, like, there's all these mysteries, you know, in virology that, you know, we don't have good answers to all these questions. And lots of people would like to say these outbreaks never happen, stuff doesn't escape from labs. But the harder you look, the worse it appears to get.
Well, the director or the head of the research, Shizheng Li, in China at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, that this is the one that's had the finger pointed at it as the source of this COVID-19. Yeah. They deny it adamantly, and they put forward as proof that they're not the source of this the fact that they've done tests of everybody that works there. I don't know if they've done tests of everybody that has worked there and might have left, or everyone that comes in and cleans the floor at night or whatever. But they say nobody that works there has the antibodies to prove that they were infected, so it couldn't have come from them, is what they're saying.
Yeah, I mean they have come out strong in their defense, but the problem is, you know, we don't have access to the samples, we can't see the experiments. Like, why can't they publish a paper showing the data, for example? Why, we don't know who was working at the lab at the time. Like, it doesn't matter if somebody had the illness and died, for example, they're no longer working at the lab. These kinds of explanations and excuses, whatever you want to call denials is probably the best word. Those denials are, they're rhetorically very strong and evidentially very weak. And this has been the consistent story.
Well, there's a website, a very interesting site. I'm sure you're aware of, A Nerd Has Power, an anonymous author. I think he's Chinese, maybe from Hong Kong, maybe from mainland China. There's a lot of very erudite comments and speculation and information on this site. One of the things that comes up again and again is that the RATG13 sample that the Wuhan Institute of Virology put forward as their starting point, they actually don't have a real sample. They just have an accounts of the sample. Am I getting this right?
Well, the story of rat G13 is going to be really interesting because, you know, there appear to be problems with this. They first put out a story that they public, that they seek, they, you know, when they discovered the virus. They were one of the lab was one of the first people to sequence the original pandemic virus. Soon as they did that, they realized that in their files, as it were, their test tubes, they had a copy of the nearest living relative of COVID-19. So they said, well, they sequenced this, and then they published it as a Nature paper along with the sequence. And what that basically did is distract from a whole narrative of where did actually that nearest living relative virus come from, the ancestor virus of the SARS-CoV-2. The theory that we are putting forward is that that virus came from a mine, and in that mine, six miners became sick with a disease that looks pretty much identical to COVID-19 in 2012. And our argument is that they took tissue samples or blood samples from those miners and were researching them at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, right? So what happens at the beginning of the outbreak is all these people are sequencing the virus, and they find that the Xi lab at WIV has in its possession a DNA RNA sequence, rather, a virus RNA sequence that's only five nucleotides different from the pandemic virus. Like, they're virtually identical. And so so everybody, you know, you can just imagine the phone calls that were going backwards and forwards. You have this virus. Why have you been working on it? What have you been doing? So on and so forth. So they magically come up with this rat G13 sequence that basically doesn't reference where it came from, although it actually comes from the same tube as the identical virus. And then they come up with the sequence all in a hurry, and now it seems like their timeline for when they sequenced that virus turns out not to be accurate. They actually were sequencing it in 2017 and 2018, which is totally contradictory to their narrative. And lastly, the point that you raised is rat G13 is not, traditionally speaking, a real virus, right? It's basically pieces of RNA from a tube, which is a very different thing from an infectious clone of a virus. Like, you can't know whether that sequence, for example, is actually valid, right? If you have an infectious clone of a virus, there's a very important distinction. Traditionally, all virology was based on infectious clones of viruses, in which people basically have a sample of a virus, and they know that when they put it into the cells, that it causes disease, and that they can get it out again and repeat that process and basically fulfill Koch's postulates. Now, Koch's postulates have never been fulfilled for rat G13 because it's just a bunch of samples that was sequenced along with a ton of other RNA molecules at the same time. So this is automatically a dubious sequence, right? And then you've got all these other issues that I just raised, mean that essentially what appears to have happened is they seem to have cobbled together some kind of a cover-up. The theory that we want to propose is that the rat G13 was what infected the miners, but it was not what caused the pandemic, in the sense that it wasn't taken by the Wuhan Institute of Virology and then manipulated. But what the Wuhan Institute of Virology probably was doing was sequencing it and maybe doing more than that, in order to basically compare it with what was in the miners. That would be our guess as to what was happening.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today to Dr. Jonathan Latham. Jonathan holds a master's in crop genetics, a PhD in virology, and he and Dr. Allison Wilson are authors of three papers that, I don't know if it's fair to say, Jonathan, if it's controversial, but at least it's taking to task the accepted wisdom of the origins of the COVID-19. What is the big difference now? I mean, couldn't, if it was made or evolved, there's a question of the purpose. I mean, you say that they've been doing this work on the viruses. There's other labs doing similar work, this so-called gain of function or gain of threat, as one interlocutor puts it. Can't they just say, well, if they were working on it, that, yeah, we made it, but, you know, it was an accident. An accident happens. Is the purpose of their research here something that's been looked into, and does it make a difference?
It makes a huge difference in our view. So basically, you know, what's happening in these labs is the Wuhan Institute of Virology is relatively typical in many ways. They're going out into the wild, they're collecting viruses, they're doing experiments on them, sometimes gain-of-function experiments, sometimes swapping experiments, sometimes passaging, which is basically putting them, allowing them to evolve in unusual cells or unusual animals. And then they're hoping to predict pandemics, make vaccines, make treatments, make diagnostic tests, right? So what these people who we are suggesting have caused this pandemic, they are claiming that they're preventing pandemics. Right. And the bottom line is that there's the likelihood is that the way that we have chosen the specific radical kind of reductionistic, a novel way that is being funded these days to prevent pandemics is actually causing them. Because there's a traditional way of preventing pandemics, right? You give people, you give doctors adequate PPE, and you have hospitals with overflows, and you have enough beds, and you have confidence in people's kind of integrity, if you like, or their trust. You have confidence in their trust in the system that they will social distance when you ask them, or that they will take the precautions that you want them to take, or they will accept the vaccine that you want them to take. And the problem is that, you know, doing this kind of reductionistic, targeted, magic bullet type research that's going on at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, which, by the way, is funded by the US in large part, that this kind of research, which is what Bill Gates is kind of famous for, right, in public health circles, this kind of research is what is going to cause pandemics in the future, right? This is my huge concern, that they're basically trashing traditional public health, you know, with the behest of Bill Gates, because it's not a profit-driven model, and they're introducing this magic bullet system of, you know, diagnosis and targeted interventions and special vaccines developed after the pandemic breaks out and so forth. But these are basically, the consequence of all this is to abandon traditional public health. And that's a horrifying prospect.
Well, even more horrifying, you cite in your article, engineered COVID-19 infected mouse bites researcher amid explosion of risky coronavirus research, as you're outlining this this increase in research after the COVID-19. You quote Mark Lipsitch of Harvard talking about gain of function or gain of threat, whichever you like. And he says that there's a 1 in 1,000 to 1 in 10,000 increased chance of release of these PPPs into the environment. But that's per these potential pandemic pathogens, PPPs, per researcher. So for every single, if there's 1,000 researchers, you know, I mean, this is they're creating the very problem that they purport to be solving, it sounds like to me.
Yeah, well, that is the very, very real danger. Yeah, that's exactly, you know, we agree 100% with Mark Lipsitch on this point, is that this explosion of research, which is also involving lots of people who don't have a lot of experience with these viruses and so forth, that this is going to lead to more and more trouble, and you end up with the danger of a vicious circle.
Well, in that article too, it's about the researcher at the University of North Carolina, one of their researchers being bitten, but the facts of this didn't come out until quite a ways down the road. And in the article, you outline that there's really no accountability because this is a self-regulating industry.
Yeah, it is, and that self-regulation has, you know, as what's led in many ways to all these spills, and scientists are, you know, becoming more and more ambitious about what they do, and their containment strategies are not keeping up, and, you know, the potential of all this biotech research, you know, it becomes more and more easy to manipulate DNA and so forth. The self-regulation system of the scientists really has to end, in my view.
Well, Jonathan, we'll break here. You can hear the entirety of this interview at guerrilla-radio.com.
Their message always to everybody through all their advertising, all their PR, everything is, we are your friends. And it's like, no, you are not our friends. Friends are not people whose bottom line is how much profit they can make out of you. It is completely different.
Guerrilla Radio, knowing who our real friends are since 1999. Right here, 11 a.m. Thursdays at cfuv.ca.
We're running out of time to put out a fire, fire.
I got this soul crow on my shoulder. The evil idol is a curious fact, and even angels can get caught in the act with the halos round the ankles. Must be something in the water. Part-time loving on a primitive scale. Two glass mantras on a hook on a rail, both trying to come together. You see me down on Easy Street, just trying to find my feet. Feels like I'm doing all the same old shit over a different beat. Let us go somewhere where all the dogs can't see. Double skate, scramble softly, they're all over your plate. I'll go and eat it all, I dare you. You see me down on Easy Street, just trying to find my feet. Feels like I'm doing all the same old shit over a different beat.
Jonathan Latham is co-founder and executive director of the Bioscience Resource Project. He's editor of Independent Science News, director of the Poison Papers Project, and he publishes a lot of his articles at jonathanlatham.net and as well as other places picking him up, Fair, Truth Out, Counterpunch, and The Ecologist, amongst other places online. Well, there's news now that one of the big questions is about the that you ask in your article is why hasn't there been mutations or recorded mutations? Now there's reports that there is what Hong Kong University claims to be the first case of reinfection. They say it's a clearly different strain that somebody that had and recovered from the first COVID-19 has now, a young person too, has now been tested with this second strain. Have you followed this?
You know, I only heard about it in the last interview that I did a few hours ago, so I haven't had a chance to look into it. But it is an interesting thing. I mean, when we talk about how the virus hasn't evolved in response to being novel to humans, right, which is, you know, one of the strongest pieces of evidence in favor of our theory is that the virus is not seemingly evolving. When SARS broke out, the original one, and MERS broke out, the first thing that happened is the virus started changing because it was not readily adapted to humans. And there's been no process of adaptation in the case of this virus. So that has raised these huge red flags, because that basically implies that this virus evolved in a human cell, and not even a human cell, but in human bodies, right? And so somebody, you know, basically when the first person out in public became infected with it, they got something from another person, which in some kind of, you know, unusual situation, i.e. probably from a lab. And so we have this concern about the virus, and this huge evidence, a piece of evidence, if you like, that the virus is not evolving. But there's a different form of virus evolution, which is what happens during the normal circulation of flu viruses, for example. You know, the population becomes immune to a certain version of the virus, and then a new strain arises that evades that immunity. And that may be what happened in this case. And it wouldn't have any bearing on our argument about whether this evolved in humans or not.
Well, if this is created in a lab, who's to say that there's not more than one form of this being created, and that they're being released either by accident or purposefully? Concurrently, there's something called the 614G variant I'm reading now. Whether it's a mutation or something separately released is a question. Or is this too conspiratorial minded?
Yeah, I don't go with the biowarfare theories, and we don't really favor the genetic engineering theories either. You know, we think that they took the samples from the hospital in Kunming where these miners became sick. They brought it home and they just started experimenting on it. And it was simply that virus that escaped. And so in a sense, a naturally occurring virus, if you want to call something from a miner's body in a hospital naturally occurring. And we just don't think that people are clever enough to make these things, you know, in that kind of knowing way. It's really hard, you know. I mean, these viruses are excruciatingly well adapted and excruciatingly complicated. And we think that people don't know enough to make a perfectly engineered and perfectly targeted virus. And this 614G mutation that you're talking about, that is a candidate for a new, for a development, for a new strain emerging. And so we're keeping an eye on that because the data is still insufficient. The jury is still out, if you like. But it is the most plausible candidate that's been proposed for a new strain coming out.
Well, we may not be clever enough as human beings, but we keep trying nonetheless. In 2014, the Obama administration put a ban on gain of function because they were terrified by a report about the H5N1, the so-called bird flu, that some a pair of scientists had weaponized, or at least had developed so that it could be transmitted over the air. Yeah. The report was to the Obama administration at the time that this could result in 1.6 billion, perhaps, deaths. They so frightened them that they brought in this ban on these GOF experimentation, a ban that was reversed at the behest of the National Institute of Health, the NIH. Why would they do that, do you think?
Well, they're part of the conflicted crowd, right? The NIH, the Wuhan Institute of Virology is being funded by the NIH ultimately. So they were giving millions of dollars every year to the Wuhan Institute of Virology using a nonprofit based in New York called the EcoHealth Alliance, as a conduit for that money. But basically, you know, the NIH has a remit to generate treatments, and its staff hold patents and generally are, you know, in bed with the rest of the vaccine, pharma, research, the pandemic virus industrial complex that I just raised. They're basically, you know, you can sort of see that they operate as a group, and they operate as a group to try to secure more money, to be more active in the research field, to make more claims, and they're using this virus outbreak as a springboard for yet more money. You know, those same operatives are using this pandemic to ask for billions instead of hundreds of millions.
Well, the head of you just mentioned EcoHealth, their president Peter Daszak, he's quoted in Nature.com online as saying the NIH has said that they will continue to fund EcoHealth Alliance, but under what he terms as heinous conditions. Yeah. Is this still another? Are these conditions the beginning of the end of self-regulation for this industry, or is this just the NIH, a sleight of hand by them saying, "Yeah, we're actually doing our job, and we're now deciding to regulate this industry, where in the past we were satisfied not to."
I'm totally with the sleight of hand explanation here. I don't think they really wish to regulate that industry. It will take a big public effort. You know, we're helping some people draw up petitions for moratoriums or bans on this kind of gain of function, gain of threat research that Andy Kimbrell called it. And I think it's really important that the public gets behind these petitions, because, you know, this kind of research, it's becoming more and more obvious, threatens us all.
Well, Andy Kimbrell, too, the ICTA, the Institute or the International Center for Technology Assessment, it's a legal outfit, and they're working on bringing cases, and they've quoted some of your work along with some of the others that we've talked about today, and they say they're bringing out a case on the origins of the COVID-19, and they're not alone. There's others that have come to back your version rather than the Anderson version of the origins of this. I'm wondering, does Anderson have any new research, the Anderson et al. Crowd? Do they have any new research that is strengthening their claim of a strictly zoonotic pathway source of this?
No, the strictly, you know, I mean, they've tried very hard to find pangolin intermediates, was their story. But basically, you know, what's become really interesting is as the research has been developed, their story has actually become weaker and weaker. Really interesting. Because, for example, we now know that almost all the pangolin sequences that are reputed by in their original paper that we critiqued, though they were saying that, pangolins have ACE2 binding, which is a human receptor that's quite similar to the SARS-CoV-2 and therefore was a likely intermediate. And pangolins look quite good because they're widely trafficked animals. But the problem is that there have been surveys of pangolins, for example, in the last few months, basically showing that pangolins don't actually harbor coronaviruses, and that the only pangolins that ever had a coronavirus appear to have been infected by people. And the second issue here is that the ACE2 binding pangolin virus, although there are four different papers about that finding, it turns out they're all based on the same DNA sequences. And it's not even clear that the researchers themselves even realized that. So people have been doing research, really, really interesting research online, showing that actually, you know, you can go back to the original sampling reads and the sampling dates and all those random sort of specificities and extract all this information about who did what research when and where are they really telling the truth about what they sequenced and why they did it. And this is the kind of research that's never been done before. But it's incredibly revealing, you know, this revealing that that the official story is on several counts totally full of holes.
Well, these pangolins, too, they're heartbreakingly timid anteaters that are smuggled illegally into China from Malaysia. There was the talk of the wet markets being the source of this in the early days. Perhaps that's been debunked as far as I'm aware, but is there a link between, say, industrial agriculture, the wet markets, and the spread of pandemics like this?
Yeah. Well, I think that the original SARS outbreak happened via farmed civets, for example. We also know that a lot of these bird flu and swine flu viruses, access humans through farmed animals. And farming animals, is a really wickedly, farming intensively animals. In, keeping them under conditions of excessive antibiotic use, very high densities of animals in poor health. This is a recipe for pandemic viruses. And so there are some people who are not sharing our story because they think that it distracts from the narrative of blaming industrial agriculture. And it's really important to blame industrial agriculture because it really is a culprit in some of these outbreaks, but our argument is not this one.
Yeah, I understand I understand exactly where you're coming from on that. And I know I'm running a little long and taking more of your time than we planned for, and I apologize for that. But I can't go without talking about the Poison Papers as well, your project. Can you talk a little bit about the Poison Projects? Am I right in saying that this is kind of like Julian Assange meets Rachel Carson?
Yeah, that's about right. I mean, we came into possession of all these documents, that the most interesting ones of which, in my opinion, come from the EPA. And the EPA, basically they show that the EPA is a co-conspirator with the chemical industry in many cases. When they release chemicals, they're often doing it in the absolute knowledge that these chemicals are going to kill people. And, I try to share this information. I've got a new article coming out that is sitting on my shelf while I've been researching COVID-19 and the origins. But basically what it shows is all the ways in which basically the EPA fails to do its job based on these internal documents. You can see that they basically invent little scientific stories in order to get toxic chemicals off the hook and make themselves feel good when they release a chemical that clearly is going to kill a lot of people. And so you have this, going back to the bigger picture of the papers, what this does is it shows that our approach to challenging toxic chemicals as being the problem is the chemical companies is not correct. We need to focus our environmentalist attention on the EPA and not consider that it's a friend in this process, but that it's actually a foe. It's part of the problem. And it was set up, you have to remember that the EPA was set up by the Nixon administration to basically nix, if you like, the influence of Rachel Carson, right? Richard Nixon knew what he was doing. He built an agency that's basically conflicted from top to bottom and therefore unable to regulate toxic chemicals. It was a deliberate ploy.
Well, I can't help but think of Frankenstein. I know it might be a bit of a trite analogy, but you do work with genetic modification on your website, and it's jonathanlatham.net. You cover a wide area, too wide. It's actually quite daunting for me as a researcher to see all the stuff that you're into. But am I simplifying or being overly romantic and using the Mary Shelley's novel again?
No, we really need scientists to step up and be responsible for their creations. You know, whether these are GMOs, whether these are chemicals, whether these are novel viruses. And the problem is that it's hard for scientists to do that when they're not aware of their own history, right? Most scientists don't know that H1N1 escaped from a lab. They don't know that HIV almost certainly was a product of a vaccine. They don't know that the best explanation of the H1N1 swine flu is that it came from a vaccine that was administered to pigs. So even virologists don't know their own history. And so if you don't know your own history of culpability, how can you possibly confront the present?
Well, when I mentioned that your position is being bolstered as time goes on, the latest one I've seen is from Perez and Montagne. They write in the International Journal of Research of an Exogenous Informative Elements, and they say, quote, that some of these 12 EIEs appear concatenated, notably the retroviral part of these regions, which consist of 8 elements from various strains of HIV-1, HIV-2, and SIV. What's the connection with HIV here? Is this something that could possibly happen naturally from a bat? I mean, isn't this the thumbprint of some human intervention?
Well, if it was true, it would be. But I actually don't agree. I know Luc Montagné has a Nobel Prize and so forth. But, you know, if you look at his paper, what they've done is try to find sequences within the COVID-19 virus that are similar to any kind of HIV that's out there. And so they've managed to find those, but I don't think there's any other virologist who thinks, I mean, you can say the same thing perhaps about our theory, except that we've had quite a few people, you know, being complimentary about it behind the scenes, if you like. But I don't think any other virologist would agree with his assessment. I mean, there's two of them wrote the paper, so they, at least the two of them agree. But we don't see why you would knock together a virus and it would maintain viability as such a hybrid between HIV and a coronavirus. I think it's too big a leap. I really don't think anybody would make such a thing, and I don't think it would work if you did make it. I think they're clutching at straws.
Well, you can appreciate how difficult it is for a layperson reading all these scientific analyses. I read these guys and it's way over my head, and everything sounds, you know, plausible and good. And because I don't understand it, I tend to think, oh, well, the scientists must know. What do you think about the role of science now and the reputation of science generally being traduced and dragged into the political milieu that is America in 2020?
Well, I mean, in a sense, it's good and bad. I mean, the scientists maintain a very good pretense of objectivity, right? But that objectivity is a pretense, right? It's not real. Scientists have conflicts of interest. They have families. They have children. They have, you know, careers to nurture. They have as many conflicts as journalists and all these other professions that also fetishize objectivity. So you have to take that objectivity with a pinch of salt. But at the same time, you know, we have a toxic political environment in which, you know, people are taking their lead from individuals like Donald Trump. You know, if Donald, you know, there's half the population, if you listen to Twitter and the major media, half the population agrees that it came from a lab because they like Donald Trump more than Nancy Pelosi. And half of the people think that it came, that it was no way that it came from a lab because they prefer Nancy Pelosi to Donald Trump. And this is not a good way of formulating opinions. And so this is causing trouble for science, unnecessary trouble. But equally, you know, if you listen to Peter Daszak, right, if you listen to his comments in Nature and on Twitter and whatever, he immediately brings in, you know, this isn't true. This is just rubbish dreamed up by Donald Trump, right? So he immediately introduces all this, the politicization that he decries so strongly. He brings it into his own narrative. And this is where you have to be very careful about promoting science as the objectivity, right? Because scientists are very adept at doing this. You know, somebody put a comment below one of our tweets the other day. As soon as an establishment scientist comes under pressure, they start woke posting, right? And that's you know, that's basically what Peter Daszak is doing. And he's doing that from a position of authority. He's in Nature or Science every single week.
Well, and Anthony Fauci, of course, has become a superstar in the media. Yeah. And he has a provenance at the, if I remember correctly, at the National Institute of Health as well, right?
Yeah, NIAID is part of the National Institutes of Health, yeah.
Well, this becomes very real, from political to real world. Now, the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta has okayed school returns in the United States, and the Department of Homeland Security has deemed education workers, quote, critical infrastructure workers.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's your take on the return to school, and is there a vaccine on the horizon? I mean, what next, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not really the right person to ask about will there be a vaccine. I mean, I'm skeptical that you can safely test a vaccine in within a few months. You know, you want to see that a vaccine does not have long-term consequences, right? That would be my strong preference. So, and you want to know, you know, it takes months to work out whether the vaccine works. Does it wear off? So on and so forth. You can't just roll out a vaccine in a month or two and expect a good outcome. So I think, you know, the likelihood on the vaccine front is you're either going to end up with one that doesn't work or one that causes a lot of trouble if it comes out quickly. So, you know, there have been efforts to indemnify the vaccine industry, right? And there's good reasons why they might want indemnities under these circumstances.
So we're not kooky to be wary of vaccine technology. Well, I said that you were interested in a lot of other things. You're also, and I don't know if this is a stay-home thing, but the Organic Connections Conference is to be held in November, or at least it's scheduled, in Saskatoon.
Canceled.
Oh, it is. Oh, okay. So we won't look forward to seeing you north of the border anytime soon then. So we should, do you think we should all stay home, or am I putting you on the spot to give that an opinion on that?
I think you're asking the wrong person. Okay. I mean, I am not personally particularly fearful of this virus, but I am fearful for my 83-year-old mother-in-law. You know, I do not want to give it to her. So I stay safe, but really for her sake. You know, there are a lot of people who are too scared of this virus. You know, it's a very interesting virus because you've got segments of the population who are significantly at risk. And then you've got large segments of the population for whom the risk is almost negligible.
Yeah, well, I have a friend who's a substitute teacher. She's 60 years old and she's worried.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, if those teachers have underlying health conditions, then that is very problematic, right? This is because they're almost bound to catch it from the children. The children may not be at home; they probably don't have underlying health conditions, but yes, those kinds of teachers are vulnerable. Tragedy.
Well, Jonathan, as I said, I've carried you way longer and you're doing other interviews again, but I will remind our listeners, Jonathan Latham is co-founder and executive director of the Bioscience Resource Project. He's editor of Independent Science News, director of the Poison Papers Project, and he publishes a lot of his articles at jonathanlatham.net and as well as other places picking him up, Fair, Truth Out, Counterpunch, and The Ecologist, amongst other places online. Jonathan, I thank you again for taking the extra time and staying on with me today. And I want to thank as well Sarah Burrell and Janine Bancroft and all the good folks that keep the wheels spinning week in and week out. That's all we've got this week. Until the next time.
During the Cold War, we used to say that the people in Eastern Europe were not allowed to speak. They could not make their voices heard. Now, the people of the West are speaking. Hear our voices. Cheer the people. Cheer the people. Because another world is possible.
Iran? No. Iraq? No. Lebanon? No. Soviet Union? Yes. United Kingdom? Abstain. United States? Yes. Uruguay? Yes. Venezuela? Yes. Yemen? No. Yugoslavia. Abstain.